third day in Mark. Today will tell us about gauge theories and the second Noether theorem. But maybe we can start with some questions from yesterday, if there's any. Otherwise, Mark.
Okay, thanks. Well, in fact, I should start by answering again a question, because I gave a very confusing answer yesterday. I'm sorry about that. What we said at the end yesterday was, I insisted first that it was true for, we started with killing vectors, and then at the end we wrote something. It was confusing. So let me just insist on the fact that if you take any vector, we have this conservation law. Let's write it. So this is true for any vector, in fact. And it's true because, in fact, we will see this later. You can compute it explicitly or use the fact that if there is an anti-symmetric tensor, you can also use this formula here for the divergence of something which is anti-symmetric. It's also true that you have this. So it's true for a vector. It's not true for a generic tensor, but it's true for an anti-symmetric tensor. So it gives you this, and this is the quantity which we called J Komar. So someone asked me yesterday, I think, and I said no. But of course, I mean, the whole point is that's the whole point of this Komar current is that they satisfy this conservation. And a bit later, we will actually rederive these Komar currents from the second theorem. We will see how they appear. And so here, just as a further application of where these currents appear. So one additional property now. So this is always true. The other property is that if the vector field is killing, then in this case, this J mu Komar, you can write it as R, the Riemann tensor, contracted with Xi. So this means that if you are in vacuum, if there is no matter, no cosmological constant, this is vanishing on shell. So this is interesting, so in the killing case, because if this is true, then you get another type of conservation law. You get that these type of integrals, if you integrate now on a sphere, you integrate this quantity, so dx. So let me take this. Yes. Thanks. Now, so in the Komar current, okay, I take this anti-symmetric object here, and I integrate this. So it has two indices. So I integrate this on a two-dimensional closed surface. So here I have the integration measure. I put the so it's a two-dimensional surface. So it has a binormal. This is what I denote by dx2 mu nu, and I contract this with. I integrate this quantity. So if this holds, this has the nice property of being actually independent of the surface over which you integrate this quantity. And that's interesting because we will see in a minute that with a proper normalization, C4 by 8 pi g, this is actually called the Komar energy. So this appears as a measure of energy. So to see that, let's continue where we started, where we stopped yesterday. And just consider weak fields. So we take a metric, G mu nu, and consider that this is a Minkowski metric, eta mu nu, plus some perturbation with, in some sense, h, very small compared to eta. And also, I take eta to be mostly plus signature. Then if you consider this, usually you also have to consider that h is time independent. You have to consider that d naught of h mu nu is zero. Then you can go ahead and linearize all sorts of quantities of interest. So the Christoffel symbols, then the Ricci tensor, the Riemann tensor, the Ricci scalar. You can linearize all these things. And you will find, combining all of this, you will find that what we're interested in is the zero zero component of the Einstein tensor. So again, all the details are in the notes. At the end of the day, you do this calculation, you find that this component of the Einstein tensor is just reduces to these spatial derivatives, HAB minus Laplacian of the trace of H. So plus terms of order H squared. This is maybe not the familiar form of this object if you have studied the weak field limit of general relativity. To obtain actually another equivalent form, you can actually use the rest of the Einstein equations. You can use this is just the time-time component of the Einstein tensor. You can use the AA component, take the trace of the AA component. Again, the details are here, and you will find that. So using again the Einstein equation, so on shell, you will find that this is also equal to so minus Laplacian of H 0, 0. So minus dA H 0, 0. So this is usually the form of the weak limit, the weak field limit that we use, for example, to match with the Newtonian limit. And to notice that G 0, 0 encodes the Newtonian potential. This is usually the form we use, but these are two equivalent forms. And now the interesting thing about that, why I wanted to mention this, so this is not meant to be a clean, proper introduction to the notion of energy in general relativity, which is a complicated topic, but this is just to motivate that just by this simple manipulation, you see that, interestingly, G00 is actually a total spatial derivative, either with this expression or with this expression. In both cases, it's a total spatial derivative. So because of this, what happens if we define this quantity here? We can consider now this object which suggestively we call E, because we integrate over a spatial slice the zero zero component of some stress energy tensor. And then we use the Einstein equations to write this as in this form, in terms of the Einstein tensor G zero zero. X G zero zero. Well, because this is a total spatial derivative, by Stokes' theorem, we will find that this is, so we have two equivalent expressions, C4 over 16 pi g, the integral over the boundary. So one expression is this one, HAB minus dA and the trace, and the other expression, so on shell, this is also equal to 8 pi g, sorry, there's a minus sign, d2xa, h00. So now what we can do, before actually computing this expression, we can now mention the relationship with this, this quantity here, so which also I call e. So maybe it's related to this. We would see that it is related. It's actually the same expression. If you use, so to do this, again, we assume that the fields are very weak. We use this assumption. But now we have to specify what the vector is. So let's assume, because we're interested in some energy quantity, that we have that xi is some time-like vector field, just d by dt. If we do this, for xi mu, which is just dt, we can show, again, the details are in the notes. This is just to tell you the idea of the ingredients that we need. We can show that we have this. Xi 0, this is minus 1 half dA H 0, 0. By the way, usually when we do these calculations, we are using Cartesian coordinates. Okay, we're using Cartesian coordinates for this Minkowski metric. So that's why we're kind of freely moving indices around. This one is upstairs. But to compute this, right, you have to pull the indices downstairs, but you bring them downstairs for free using Cartesian coordinates. So this is why A is downstairs here. And you will also find that the symmetric version of this is just the same thing with a plus sign, H00. So this means that if you compute this quantity here, E comma R, this comma R energy, just have to be careful about the fact that now I need kind of two normals to specify the location of this surface. One of the, so this you can think of these two surfaces as being at constant time and constant radius. And so if we compute now this thing, minus C4 over 8 pi g, d2x, so this thing here, we'll just pick up 0a component, 0a component, and using this, this becomes just equal to, this expression, sorry, the one with, okay. In fact, here there is no choice, right? Here there are two equivalent expressions which are related by using the equations of motion. Here there is no choice. You get this from the onset. You don't get this expression. So you get this. Okay, and now to get a feeling of what this means, we can just evaluate this for the quintessential test metric in general relativity, which is the Schwarzschild metric. So for the Schwarzschild metric, with the kind of signature convention that we have here for Schwarzschild, we find that, let me write, continue here. The question is, what is H00? So H00 is, so with our choice of signature here for Schwarzschild, we have G00, which is minus 1 plus Schwarzschild radius over R. So this is H00. Then when we compute this integral, we just get a factor of 4 pi r squared, and then d by dr of this. Okay, so d by dr of this, 4 pi r squared. So at the end of the day, we get that this comma integral is equal to, so minus c4 over 8 pi g, 4 pi r squared. D by dr of rs over r, and this is just c4 rs over 2g, yes. But the Schwarzschild radius rs is 2gm over c2. So this cancels nicely, and we get m c squared. So we get that the value of this, so now there's two objects, but the value of this Komar integral, which now we call the Komar energy, or the Komar mass, gives the mass of the Schwarzschild black hole, the mass of the Schwarzschild solution. And equivalently, if we compute this using this formula, you get the same result because of this. The only kind of subtle difference at this point is that these are a bit, this definition was a bit sketchy because we use this prescription to define this. So this is a bit intuitively, by analogy with what we do in usual field theory, we say that the energy is this component encoded in this component of the energy momentum tensor. Then we arrived at this. Then using the Einstein equations, we arrived at this. If you actually were to use this expression, you would need to actually use an asymptotic expansion. This result would not be exact. The nice thing about this expression, however, is that the result here is exact. So this is because at the heart, if you were to actually study the proper covariant definition of these notions of energy, these are slightly different energies. So this is related to what we will see later called the ADM energy, and this is really the Komar energy. So there are these different notions of energy and mass in general relativity, and one has to be careful about them. Yes? Yes, the Komar integral is this, is the integral over a 2 surface, d2x mu nu lambda mu xi nu. Okay, and so what this shows also, the point here was to, so there were two objectives. The first objective was to actually use this Comar integral, and the second objective was to give an example of a computation that spits out the mass of the Schwarzschild black hole, and also importantly to show that this energy, this mass, is given by a surface integral. And the reason for this is that, what we will see now, is that interesting conserved quantities in gauge theory, like here the energy, are associated to surface integrals. So sometimes people say that classically this is kind of a manifestation of the fact that gravity is in a sense holographic in nature, because it has this tendency of encoding relevant physical information on the boundary of spatial regions. So we see that it's the case here with the energy. So the question, of course, is whether this remains true however you define a quantum theory of gravity. And if this is true, this is what we think is true in ADS-CFT, for example. And this is what kind of supports the idea of holography. But this is just kind of a little classical example pointing towards this property of general relativity. Okay, so now we can move to gauge theories, do something else, but then these objects will appear again. We'll see kind of where this type of structure is also hiding when we study the gauge property of general relativity, which again we haven't done here, but we will see that everything will reappear. Okay, so now we move to gauge theories. So that's part chapter 3. Gauge theories. Yeah, sorry if you hope that this would be, in fact, the beginning, and if you had to wait until today to really move on to gauge theories, because the lecture was announced as a lecture on gauge theories. But I thought it would be nice to start from the beginning. So we can just start by thinking about the general properties of gauge theories, and then illustrate this on examples and try to see what the structure actually is. So the properties are the following. There are some features shared by gauge theories, and these features are all related to one another. So the point now is to understand how all these things are intertwined. So the first thing is that a gauge theory has, gauge symmetry, of course. Gauge symmetry. It also has relations between the equations of motion. The equations of motion are not all independent in a gauge theory. And this is a consequence of the fact that there is gauge symmetry, as we will see. Because of this, there is also arbitrary functions in the solutions. In fact, you have more variables than equations of motion, so some of the variables are left undetermined. And this is a crucial feature of a gauge theory. You will see that there is this notion in the Hamiltonian picture of first-class constraints. These first-class constraints are the generators of these gauge transformations, of these gauge symmetries. And another feature is that in gauge theories, you can, that's the point of what we do now, you can talk about surface charges. So all these things are related, so let's see now exactly how this is related. So to do that, I think we go a bit the other way around. When we started in mechanics, we talked about Lagrangian, then we moved to Hamiltonian. I think here it's better to evacuate the Hamiltonian picture first. This is where there's lots of interesting structure. Then go back to the Lagrangian, and then we'll go back to the Hamiltonian a bit later. So we go a bit back and forth between Lagrangian and Hamiltonian. So 3.1, the Hamiltonian formalism. So Hamiltonian formulation. So unfortunately, we cannot review the whole theory of Hamiltonian formalism for gauge theories, and I'm sure you know part of it already. So let me just summarize what is important for the discussion that we are having today. Well, the point is that I mentioned here these first class constraints and these gauge symmetries. So let's see how this is related. So the point is that the general form of the Hamiltonian in a gauge theory, it always has the same form. It has the following form. So you can always write the Lagrangian in Hamiltonian picture is PAQ. I just write a mechanical model here. Okay, I don't write field theory indices. You could also do this in one dimension, but okay, it has this form. There is a piece in the Hamiltonian that we call H naught, and there is a piece which is, I use a different index now, I. I can be anything, 1, 2, 3. It's not related to the spatial dimension or space-time dimension. This labels the number of constraints, and lambda are the so-called Lagrange multipliers. And H naught is called usually the true Hamiltonian of the theory. So the point is that in Hamiltonian form, in a gauge theory, the Hamiltonian is a sum of a true Hamiltonian and a set of first-class constraints. In fact, when you take a given Lagrangian, you want to write it in Hamiltonian form, you don't necessarily immediately end up with this, because in fact, there might be actually second-class constraints. Second-class constraints, they are not directly related to the gauge properties. You can really think of them as kind of really redundancies in the system, which there are algorithmic ways to get rid of them. So you may know that this procedure of obtaining the correct Hamiltonian form of the Lagrangian is called the Dirac algorithm. So it's a Dirac algorithm for systems with constraints. When you go through this Dirac algorithm, you might encounter first-class constraints and second-class constraints. But at the end of the day, you can always manage to put the Lagrangian in this form, where only these first-class constraints appear. So now I have to tell you what is a first-class constraint, because it's not, I just wrote C for the moment. So what is the property of this first-class constraint? And why, if these properties are satisfied, why this implies that there is gauge symmetry? That's the whole point. OK, so the point is that is the following. So first-class constraints, what does it mean? Means the following thing. It means that if you take two of these constraints, Ci, Cj, you compute the Poisson bracket between them, it has to close again on one of the constraints, maybe a combination of them. So let's put some coefficient f here, Fijk, Ck. So the right-hand side could be 0, or it could be a combination of constraints. So this has to be satisfied. In fact, if when you go through this algorithm, you find at some point constraints that don't satisfy this, this means that there are maybe second-class constraints, and we know how to get rid of them. But again, at the end of the day, every Lagrangian can be put in this form. General relativity, Maxwell theory, Yang-Mills, Chern-Simons theory, any gauge theory has this form. And the first-class constraints, they satisfy this. And they also satisfy, when you compute them, when you commute them with the true Hamiltonian H naught, here you just find, call this Fij, Cj. So there is an F with 3 indices and an F with 2 indices. And now we can show just with this, so it's in fact very kind of minimal assumption about the structure of the theory. We didn't even say what this C is. We're just saying that the Lagrangian has this form and that this C satisfies this set of Poisson bracket relations. Now we can show that just with this, the theory has gauge symmetries. Okay, so by the way, I should have said that we call these constraints because if you look at the variational principle now in Hamiltonian form, you see that these lambdas here, when you vary with respect to them, you get that Ci is vanishing. Okay, so these lambdas are really Lagrange multipliers imposing some equations of motion. These equations of motion are the vanishing of Ci. And so these objects Ci, which are vanishing on shell, they are generators of symmetries. So these are a bit the analogs of the Noether charge for global symmetries. that generate symmetries. Here for gauge theories, the analog of the Noether charge is played by these constraints. But these are constraints, so they're vanishing on shell. So you see they don't have the same status as a true Noether charge. A Noether charge is not vanishing on shell, and it generates a symmetry. This is an object which vanishes on shell, yet it generates a symmetry, as we will show. Yes? Ah, the cube, yes. Sorry. Catch it?
Thank you. I wanted to ask about the possibility to write a Lagrangian in this form always, because when I start with a Lagrangian and want to go to Hamiltonian vice versa, I'm thinking of Legendre transform. Mm-hmm. But now if I have constraint, I always thinking about that I can't invert a momenta for velocities and vice versa. But somehow it seems to be still possible to define such canonical momenta plus Hamiltonian and constraint. So could you explain somehow why this is?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, that's exactly the point. You see, because there are some, it's a point I could have added here, in fact. In the gauge theory, the Lagrangian, in the Lagrangian, there are these Lagrange multipliers, which in fact are variables which have no, don't come with a time derivative in the Lagrangian. Mm-hmm. So they don't have in the Lagrangian a canonical momentum associated to them. So because of this, the Hessian of the Lagrangian is degenerate, and so there are some points where the Legendre transform is not invertible. So this kind of prevents you from blindly computing this Legendre transform. This is why to actually compute this, you have to carefully go through an algorithm. And the algorithm in particular implies introducing by hand momenta for these Lagrange multipliers, together with constraints imposing that these momenta actually vanish.
Okay.
So the momentas are not there. So you introduce them by hand with a multiplier saying that, in fact, they're not there. And you can, the Dirac algorithm is a completely consistent way of doing that. And at the end of the day, getting a Lagrangian in this form. There is in the notes an example, a mechanical example where I work this out.
So in that case, the constraints would be all equations of motion that are not dynamical, so that don't involve time derivatives or only first order time derivatives.
Not necessarily. You will see in the example that the constraints can. That's not necessarily the case, but. Because in fact, then there is another step, which is actually to find from the constraint the proper generator of the gauge transformations. And this is some, mm-hmm. can be also a bit complicated, but we will get to that.
Okay, thank you.
But there is an example we can discuss later in the notes. I don't do it here in details because I don't want to run out of time, but we can discuss later. So now let's show how this happens. So the first thing is that we need to, again, say how the fields transform. Let's say that Q transforms as epsilon I, so by Poisson bracket, of course. Ci acting on Q, so this is just epsilon I dCi by dP. And on P, this is also acting by Poisson bracket. So this is minus epsilon I dCi by dQ. In fact, to show that there is a gauge symmetry of this system, you have to also prescribe how the Lagrange multipliers transform. Because in Maxwell theory, this would be the time component of the gauge field. In the ADM formulation of general relativity, these are the so-called lapse and shift quantities. So you have to prescribe how these fields transform. You cannot know how they transform. So to transform them, I just tell you what the transformation is, but you can actually derive this. I do it the other way around in the notes. In the notes, you see that you have to impose this to have a symmetry. So the way they transform is like this. Epsilon I dot plus Fij epsilon j minus F jki lambda j epsilon k. By the way, I should insist on the fact that we will discuss now gauge symmetries. So the parameters of these gauge symmetries, they can be here time dependent or more generally space-time dependent. You see, that's why here we have epsilon dot. This is a new thing which we have not seen for the moment. A symmetry with a parameter that can have a space-time derivative. So that's because we're in a gauge theory. And now just with this, you can check. So how to check that? You take the variation of the Lagrangian, okay? you write this as if you were computing the equations of motion. So you differentiate H naught with respect to the canonical variables Q and P. You have a variation of lambda, and you vary C with respect to the variables Q and P. Now you replace all the variations by these transformations. And you do these four lines of calculations, and you will find that delta epsilon of L is a boundary term. So we indeed have a symmetry, and the boundary term is, as is expected, QA minus epsilon I CI. In the notes, I do it the other way around. I don't impose this. I just put this in the Lagrangian. And at the end, there is a term like this which is left, this minus this. So this tells you that to get a symmetry, you have to impose that the Lagrange multiplier transforms like this. So in fact, it's a bit miraculous in a sense. We just started from a very general form of a Lagrangian. We just said that there are some phase space functions here, n of them, which just satisfy these relations. And we just show that if they satisfy this, well, you just define these transformations, you get a symmetry of the Lagrangian. And moreover, you get a gauge symmetry of the Lagrangian because this parameter can be time dependent. And you see that for this to work, it's completely crucial to have these constraints and these Lagrange multipliers, and that the Lagrange multipliers transform in a prescribed way. So this is the why there is this deep relationship between these first class constraints, the presence of arbitrary functions, the Lagrange multipliers, and the gauge symmetry. So you see how these three things are related. Okay, so now what time is it? Okay. Yeah, we can do, so there's one particular example of gauge symmetry. One physically important example of that is, for example, for systems which are of this form. But what can happen is that the system can be such that there is no true Hamiltonian. It can happen that there is no true Hamiltonian and that there are only constraints in the Hamiltonian H. So there is no H naught. This is, of course, the case of general relativity. It's also the case of a relativistic particle. For a relativistic particle, there is no true Hamiltonian. The true Hamiltonian H naught is identically zero. The only thing you have is a constraint, the mass shell constraint, that p squared plus m squared is equal to zero. And because of this, we can just show now on this mechanical example that if H0 is vanishing, the theory is invariant under time reparametrizations. So in general relativity, this is it's not just time reparametrizations, but it's reparametrization of all the coordinates, so diffeomorphism invariants. So in general relativity, because of diffeomorphism invariants, of general covariance or invariance under changes of coordinates, the true Hamiltonian is vanishing. So we kind of understand that this is why defining energy, for example, in general relativity is more subtle, because it's a gauge theory, it's completely reparametrization invariant. The true Hamiltonian is completely vanishing on shell. The only thing you have are constraints. These constraints are vanishing on shell. So the Hamiltonian is zero on shell. So how can you use the Hamiltonian to define energy? Because it's vanishing on shell. Well, the answer, as we saw a bit earlier, is that the important information is hiding in the boundary terms. So you have to be extremely careful about the boundary terms in the Hamiltonian. So later we will see how to actually collect these boundary terms. How do we access them? Okay, so let me go back to the example of time reparametrization. So we take a bit the same system, and we just take these transformations, delta epsilon on Q. This is epsilon Q dot, delta epsilon on P. This is epsilon P dot. And delta epsilon on lambda can be lambda I. It's epsilon dot lambda I plus epsilon lambda I dot. Using this, you can show that any constraint Ci, so to show this again, to show this thing, you have to use the fact that C is a phase space function, so it depends on P and Q. So this is partial C by partial Q delta Q plus partial C by partial P delta P. You plug delta P and delta Q inside of this form, and you will find that this is should be epsilon C dot. It's equal to this. With this, you find that if H0 is vanishing, so if H0 is vanishing in this formula, again, you compute the variation of the Lagrangian, you plug these transformations in the Lagrangian, and you find that if and only if H0 is vanishing, the Lagrangian transforms in this way. So it's a symmetry, so you get a boundary term, dt, and you get P delta epsilon Q minus epsilon lambda ICi. And again, this epsilon is completely arbitrary. So you're doing a completely arbitrary relabeling of the time coordinate. And this is a symmetry of your theory. But this only works if this total Hamiltonian is vanishing. So this is showing that even within gauge theories are different for example, for this reason. Some of them can have a true Hamiltonian, like in the Maxwell case. In the Maxwell case, there is a constraint. It's the Gauss constraint imposed by the time component of the gauge field, and there is a true Hamiltonian, B squared plus E squared. But in general relativity, there is no true Hamiltonian. By the way, you also see from this, I should have said earlier, that for these gauge symmetries, well, this is already the form in which you can apply Noether theorem. That's already the form. So this is what we call the d epsilon, the first theorem. Right, and the Noether charge from the first theorem is this minus B epsilon. So you get that this is the Noether charge. This is the Noether charge from the first theorem. But now this Noether charge is vanishing on shell now because it's just a constraint. And these constraints, they vanish on shell. Okay. So. So this is why you often find the statement that for gauge symmetries, the Noether theorem gives a trivial result. It's because of this. But it's because it's the first theorem. You will see that, in fact, there is the second Noether theorem, which gives you some non-trivial structure. This is a bit, it's true, but it's a bit unsatisfactory. It doesn't contain much information, it seems. So we will see the information given by the second theorem. So let's do a more specific example, more precise example. So it's a mechanical example again. So the example is to just take this Lagrangian. You take L, 1/2, let's call it x, q dot. So you have two configuration variables, q and x. Here you have the standard kinetic term, q dot squared, but then there is this shift by x, which is a time-dependent variable. Now you compute the variation, okay? And we get that this is minus q dot dot minus x dot delta q minus q dot minus x delta x, and plus the boundary term is d by dt, q dot minus x, delta q. So the first thing to notice is what we said is that, so all these things are intertwined, so it doesn't matter in which order you kind of discover these things. Either you already know that there is a gauge symmetry, it's a bit obvious here, or you don't know. Well, then you can compute the equations of motion. And if you're lucky, it's obvious that the equations of motion are related. And you see here it's the case. This equation of motion is the time derivative of this one. So you have two equations of motion, but they're not independent. One is the time derivative of the other one. And just this fact, the fact that the equations of motion are related, is a manifestation of the fact that there is a gauge symmetry in this theory. And the gauge symmetry is what? The gauge symmetry is this transformation. Well, even in a, at the finite level here, it's even, you just change Q to Q plus epsilon and X to X minus epsilon dot. Okay, these transformations leave the Lagrangian identically invariant. And there are gauge transformations, epsilon can depend on time. And if you compute the Noether charge arising from these gauge transformations, well, we know already from here, you will find something which is, you will find the Noether charge, but it's trivial on shell. If you compute the Noether charge here, you find Q epsilon, this is just epsilon Q dot minus X. So on shell, this is just an equation of motion, it's this. So you find, so you have a theory, it has gauge symmetry, you compute the Noether charge, the Noether charge is just proportional to the equation of motion. So on shell, this Noether charge is trivial. And in fact, in mechanics, there is not more structure. If you have a gauge theory in mechanics, this happens, and that's it. You're done, you cannot extract really anything else that's interesting. But for a field theory, we will see that we can extract something which is interesting, which is precisely these surface terms. You will see in the notes there is a whole section about actually the Hamiltonian analysis of this, and this was your question, Joanna. Because here you have immediately this problem. X appears without canonical variable, canonical momentum, there is no X dot. So the Legendre transform is ill-defined. So to actually write this in Hamiltonian form, we have to go through several steps. You first have to introduce a momentum for X with a constraint that this momentum is vanishing. Then you have to evolve this constraint in time, go through this Dirac algorithm, but you can do that completely explicitly in here. So everything is done here. Okay, now, okay, so I hope it's clear that there is this relationship between gauge symmetry, the presence of Lagrange multipliers, and the fact that there are first-class constraints. So now let's discuss Maxwell theory in more details. So first of all, to see, again, this structure in Maxwell theory, but also to discuss what we already mentioned, which is this notion of surface terms. Where do these surface terms arise from? What is happening with these surface terms? So 3.2. So again, this was not meant to have a completely consistent way to do Hamiltonian analysis, but it was just to argue that there is this relationship between gauge symmetry and constraints. Now let's just assume that we have this. We have a gauge theory in Hamiltonian form. Let's see how we can, what happens with the surface terms. So for that, we look at Maxwell. Okay, so we take the Lagrangian to be, now I put again the minus 1/4, unlike yesterday, mu nu f mu nu. Again, all the steps are here. All the complete details, you do many steps. The steps just involving separating space and time, right? Here I have some time components and spatial components. I isolate them, do some integration by parts. At the end of the day, you find this. You find the electric field conjugated to spatial component of the gauge field. Plus A0 dA EA minus 1/2 EA EA plus 1/4 FAB FAB plus actually a boundary term, A0 EA. So that's the Hamiltonian form of the Maxwell Lagrangian. Yes? Yeah. Is it, sorry, what, observer dependent, you said? No, there are no auxiliary variables here. Here, really, the phase space variables are QP and lambda. There is nothing, this is the true, in fact, you see here on Maxwell, there is nothing auxiliary. This is, the field content here is the same as in the initial Lagrangian, right? It's just that to put this in manifestly Hamiltonian form, you have to, well, the Legendre transform tells you what are the canonical variables. So here it's this component of the gauge field. It's conjugated to the electric field. Here with my conventions, I think EA is minus F0A. That's the electric field. That's what's conjugate to A. And then it has exactly this structure, right? There is a boundary term. This is the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian has two very different pieces. One of them is H naught. It's this. That's a true Hamiltonian. This is here, no matter what you do. This is here. It's not zero. It's a, right? So that's E squared plus 1/2 E squared plus B squared. But now there is this term. This is a constraint, right? A naught, A zero is the Lagrange multiplier. It has no canonical counterpart. If you vary with respect to A naught, the equation you get is the Gauss constraint. Divergence of E is zero. Okay, so delta L delta A naught implies EA equals zero. That's the Gauss constraint. Okay. So that's just the Hamiltonian form of Maxwell, right? Now we just proved before, not in field theory, but in mechanics, but okay, it's the same structure. We just showed that if you have a constraint like this, well, this Gauss constraint is, of course, a first class constraint. If you take this Gauss constraint now, it should generate the gauge symmetries of the theory. That's what we just showed earlier, that the first class constraints generate gauge transformations. So let's see explicitly how this happens with this. And you will see that to actually do this properly, you have to be careful about surface terms. So to do that, so there is one thing to discuss, which is the differentiability of the constraint. This is what we have to be mindful about. So for this, we look at the smeared Gauss constraint. So this is G integrated on a 3D slice. So really, the Lagrangian is just, you should think of this as an integral over time of the Lagrangian in Hamiltonian form. So there are spatial integrals are included in the definition of the Hamiltonian, and here of the constraint.
Matt?
And here I'm replacing, I'm replacing.
In this form, in the Maxwell case, we had, like in the most general form, we wrote P Q dot plus H zero, and then the constraints. Lambda I, ci.
Yes.
But what is that? The last term in that, would the whole thing be the Hamiltonian?
This one?
Yeah.
Well, this one, I kept it because I didn't want to cheat or to, because to discuss surface terms, I have to keep surface terms otherwise. Although you will see this, this one is actually not so important for the discussion. No matter whether you put it or not, usually we drop this thing, usually. So very often when you see the Hamiltonian formulation, usually when you go from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian picture, you already drop some surface terms. And in fact, you will see that the surface terms that you drop, they're related to the surface terms that we will get here. So for Maxwell, it's a bit obvious. There is sometimes this. We will see this briefly later with the ADM Hamiltonian in general relativity.
So the general form of the Lagrangian that you wrote down earlier, it was not including the surface terms?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. So now what we What we typically do, when I learned this, when I was working on these constraints, I just learned that, you know, you have a first class constraint to act on a variable. Well, when you act by Poisson bracket, there are Dirac deltas. So to integrate them, the object which is well behaved is the smeared constraint. You integrate this against the test function alpha that replaces a knot. And now you put the constraint. So this is the generator. This is supposed to be the generator of the gauge transformation. Well, let's see how this works. So now with the canonical Poisson bracket coming from this, I go back to really field theory notation here is AX EBY. This is delta BA and a 3D delta function, X minus Y. With this, immediately you get that. You get that the action of this smeared Gauss constraint on the gauge field by Poisson bracket, the action is, well, you see, to compute this action, this is why we do this smearing, in fact, because what is conjugated to A is E. Here we have derivative of E. So see, if you just use the Poisson bracket between A and E inside of the derivative, I get derivative of a delta, which is not nice. So the proper way to do that is to just integrate by parts here. So usually, when you first learn that, you just integrate by parts blindly, and you just say that this is minus AA, and the integral still over sigma, d3x, of dA alpha. Now, I integrated this by parts, and now EA is free. So now you can take the, well, this should be B, sorry. DB EB, and now you can take the Poisson bracket between A and E, okay? And what you get is minus dA alpha. So you get what you expect. You get the gauge transformation of the spatial component of the gauge field, right? So this shows indeed that the Gauss constraint is the generator of these gauge transformations. By the way, you see that this is kind of incomplete, because here we're only transforming the spatial component of the gauge field. In the Lagrangian picture, the gauge transformation is the whole space-time components, right? Is this. So this is why earlier I said I also gave a prescription for how to transform the multipliers. This is something, sometimes in the literature you don't actually find this formula for how to transform the multipliers, so it's a bit confusing how the gauge constraints generate full space-time gauge transformations. Well, this is because you can act on the canonical variables, but you can also act on the Lagrange multipliers. There are formulas for this. In any case, let's go back to this. No, you see, as you expect, that you take the constraint, you act by Poisson bracket on the phase space variables, and you generate a gauge transformation. That's exactly what's happening. However, for this to actually really make sense, we should remember that, in fact, just like when we do a variational principle, we say that the action should be functionally differentiable, so we have to be careful about the boundary term. Here it's the same thing. In fact, the Poisson brackets, they're mathematically properly defined with functional derivatives. So to actually compute this, I have to make sure that this quantity here is functionally differentiable. And because there is a derivative here, to look if this is functionally differentiable or not, we will pick up a boundary term, a surface term. That's the one we have to keep track of. So, however, the Poisson bracket is defined as, so in the following way. So you have these functional derivatives, for example, A with respect to B, this would be delta AB delta 3 x minus y. And when we take two phase space functions, f and g, the Poisson bracket, this is really defined like this. It's really this and, I stick to a and e here. This is completely general for any phase space, but I stick to a and e. Delta ax, delta g, delta ex minus fg. So that's the definition of the Poisson bracket. So for this to make sense, this object has to exist and be functionally differentiable. So let's see if this is the case, and manifestly it's not the case here. Because if we take a variation of the Gauss constraint, let's take a variation of the Gauss constraint. So for the Gauss constraint. So by the way, I'm being very I'm not very generous on citing people, but there are citations in the notes and references. This idea of studying carefully the differentiability of the constraint and the boundary term goes back to Redge and Teitelbaum. So this is usually known as the Redge-Teitelbaum criterion.
Mark? Also in the when we do the integration by parts in the case there also you should have a surface term, right?
Well, that's the point. So here I said I was blind about this. So when I learned this, I was always doing this integration by parts because I was just interested in these things, for example. If you're just interested in what kind of transformation the first class constraints generate, then this holds. But you're completely right. There is a surface term here. So you're completely right. So for the Gauss constraint, so to be sure, let me write, I don't know. So this is if the boundary is empty. If there is no boundary, then you can do that. If there is a boundary, you compute the variation, and you get, let me write it. Let me drop the D3X, okay? Just drop the D3X. Let me also assume that alpha does not depend on the fields, that alpha is just a function that does not depend on the phase space functions. So my variation doesn't have to hit on alpha. And then you want to integrate this by parts, just like when you compute the Euler-Lagrange equations, or now you have to remove this derivative. So this is minus delta A alpha delta EA plus a surface term. Surface term is A delta EA. Sorry, alpha delta EA. So there should be a normal here to pick up this index, alpha delta EA. And so now the point is, you know, what happens with this surface term? What should we do with this surface term? So essentially two things can happen. Either your boundary conditions are such that the surface term vanishes. For example, the gauge transformation could vanish at infinity, and then this would drop. But the general thing, what can happen if this surface term does not die at infinity? One prescription is actually to take this surface term and bring it on the left-hand side. So define so if the surface term does not vanish, we define. So someone could come and say, no, but you just took the wrong phase space function. You thought this was the generator of gauge transformations, but this phase space function is not differentiable. So you have to use a phase space function which is differentiable. And so the way to get a phase space function which is differentiable is just to subtract this boundary term produced by this variation here. So you can define instead g tilde of alpha, which is g alpha, this one, minus this boundary term. And again, I remove the variation delta here. This is now such that when I take the variation of this, I get just this piece. And now this can act by Poisson bracket to give this. So now this is well defined. I can really act by Poisson bracket to induce the proper gauge transformation. So this is fixed now, this problem. But now something else is happening. Now there's a trade-off. This is made rigorous now. But the price for this is that you see that this generator. So this is the true gauge generator. But you see that this gauge generator now, on shell, is not zero anymore. Because the G piece, this is the Gauss constraint. This is zero on shell. But on shell, you have this surface term which remains. So now you see that. That's why if you have a boundary in a gauge theory, depending on the boundary conditions, if these surface terms survive, then it can happen that because of the boundary, a gauge symmetry, which had a trivial Noether charge, because it was generated by a constraint, actually becomes a bit more like a true Noether symmetry. It has a non-vanishing charge associated to it. And by construction, this charge is always a surface charge. So again, we end up with this notion of this idea that interesting things are happening on the surface. And that's exactly for this reason. OK? So on shell, g tilde of alpha is not equal to 0. It's equal to this surface term. So not all gauge transformations are equivalent, in fact. There are gauge transformations, but in fact, there is a bit a hierarchy of gauge transformations. There are those which are generated by a true constraint, which is vanishing on shell, and those like this one, which are generated by an object, a generator, which is not vanishing on shell. But at most, what you can have on shell is a surface term. So sometimes you find the statement in some notes or books that if you have a boundary because of this, a gauge symmetry can become a Noether symmetry. So don't be confused by that. It kind of depends on what the author means by, I don't know if you should separate gauge and Noether in this sense, but because you can still associate a Noether charge to these gauge symmetries, it would just be zero. But here it's in the sense that the generator is not zero anymore. So you can associate to the generator of a gauge transformation, you can associate to it a non-vanishing object, which at most is a surface charge, is a surface term. Let me skip maybe the, I just sketch you very briefly the next part, but again, everything is in the notes. Is that from this, the nice thing is that now it connects to what we started with today, the fact that, well, exactly the same structure, the same thing is true in general relativity for the Hamiltonian. Yes, there's a question.
Is this boundary term connected to the presymplectic potential that you defined in one of the previous lectures?
It will be. It's not because it's a different type of object, but we will see the relationship between these two things probably tomorrow.
Okay,
tomorrow we will have a machinery to actually almost automatically produce these relevant surface terms. And this will use the presymplectic potential.
Okay, thank you.
So there are many kind of ways to navigate through these things and these properties. I just want to sketch you how the different possibilities, and hopefully you see that everything is kind of related. So now one of these relationships is the relation that we, between what we did before and this notion of surface terms. Because now the same thing, what Regge and Teitelbaum did, was in fact, their interest was general relativity. In general relativity, the same structure exists. I skip the details, but everything is in the notes. The point is that, so in GR, I just write this. In GR, in Hamiltonian form, you're taking your four-dimensional space-time manifold, you're foliating the space-time manifold into space-like hypersurfaces and a time coordinate. And then the action in Hamiltonian form, this is the ADM Hamiltonian, has this form. So the conjugate variables are the spatial, the metric on the spatial slice. There's a conjugate momentum which depends on components of the extrinsic curvature. And the point is just this. The point I want to make is just that. Again, all the formulas and notations and conventions are in the notes, or in the, you find this in many textbooks. But this is the Hamiltonian for general relativity. Again, there's a canonical term. That's the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is a sum of constraints, a bit because of what we said before. General relativity is completely reparametrization invariant. And because of this, there cannot be a true Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian has to be a sum of constraints. And there are two constraints. This one imposed by the Laplace, this is called the scalar constraint or Hamiltonian. This may be confusing to call it the Hamiltonian constraint, but scalar Hamiltonian, and this is called the vector constraint or the momentum constraint. Essentially, the gauge transformations, so these are first class constraints, so we know that they generate gauge transformations. The gauge transformations generated by these first class constraints are reparametrizations of the foliation in time, and these are diffeomorphisms within the spatial hypersurface generated by the vector constraint. So this is like four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance, which is now split in time and space diffeomorphism invariance. That's just the structure, but to connect with this, the whole point is that to make this thing precise, for these quantities to actually be the generator of diffeomorphisms, these quantities have to be functionally differentiable because of this. And now you know how to systematically do that. You look at the form of these constraints. It's actually not so complicated. You look at the form of these constraints. You compute the variation of these constraints. You see that when you compute the variation, you pick up surface terms, just like here. And then you conclude that the proper generator of the gauge transformations, they are not really the constraints. They are the constraints plus surface terms, the so-called ADM surface terms. And this is why, now again, for the same reason as here, on shell now, the Hamiltonian is vanishing as a constraint, but the true generator of the gauge transformations is not vanishing. It's vanishing up to a surface term. And precisely this surface term is, in some setups, agrees with the energy that we defined earlier, with the Komar energy. So if you apply, you evaluate this on a Schwarzschild solution, these surface terms will give you mc squared, will give you the mass of the, yes?
So I think I'm a bit hung up on the terminology, like the true generator of the gauge symmetry. I'm trying to motivate it. I guess I'm thinking maybe from like these Poisson brackets between A and our original smeared Gauss constraint. Like there should be like another term, I'm guessing, and then the redefinition of G to G tilde gets rid of that term in this Poisson bracket, so it actually does generate the gauge symmetry. Like, does our default, I guess my question is, does our default smeared Gauss constraint actually satisfy that Poisson bracket in the sense of generating the gauge transformation, or is it really just G tilde and we didn't write a term down for the
G? Yeah, it's really G tilde. This one does not satisfy this.
Yeah, yeah. But so in this Poisson bracket, like, should there be an extra term, not just the partial of alpha?
Oh yeah, there should be. But that's why I put this prescription here.
Right. Okay.
That there is no boundary here.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Makes sense.
Yes. In fact, one thing what you had in mind is that you could think, why do I have to do this? In fact, you could think I could maybe just take this, actually keep the boundary, integrate by parts. Now there is one part which acts like this, and then there is the surface term, and I act with the surface term. But you cannot actually do that because on the surface you don't actually have a well defined. There's no way here to take a Poisson bracket on the surface itself. And you will see later that, in fact, you will see a bit later with an example that the Poisson, these surface terms here, why they're also interesting is that they give you some algebraic structures. They also satisfy Poisson brackets. And these Poisson brackets, they are a bit counterintuitive from the point of view of the bulk symplectic structure. For example, in Yang-Mills theory, the electric field commutes with itself. So if you see from the point of view of the bulk symplectic structure, this Poisson bracket with itself would be zero. But actually, you will see that Poisson bracket of this with itself is actually not zero. It gives you, again, this thing with the commutator of the gauge parameters, which is a bit in kind of contradiction with the bulk symplectic structure. But that's the proper way to actually compute these Poisson brackets. So the point of tomorrow will to have the proper machinery to compute this. So that's why here you have no other choice than either removing the boundary or redefining the generator like this.
Uh,
Mark, also, is there a reason we call this scalar constraint the Hamiltonian constraint? Is there like C0 is of the same form as H0 and only on shell it becomes zero?
No, this is why I said that this is a bit confusing to call it Hamiltonian constraint. It's just the abuse of language, I think, that people call this the Hamiltonian constraint.
So, but
I think they call it Hamiltonian because it has to do with the time direction. Usually Hamiltonian mechanics is time evolution, but so it's just scalar constraint.
Okay.
But the point is that it has, that's the total Hamiltonian H-naught, that's H. Mm-hmm. H-naught is identically zero, and then it's the sum of constraints. That's H, and it has two constraints, and no true Hamiltonian. Yes, so to conclude, what I wanted to say is that if you do the careful analysis of the surface terms here, you end up with another definition of the energy, which is called the ADM energy. Let me skip that, but I hope you get the idea that this is completely generic structure now. So for any gauge theory, you have to be careful about that, especially in general relativity. So it means that to properly define the action of these constraints, you have to be careful about the surface terms. The proper generators, they actually contain surface terms. So on shell, they're not zero. So when we said earlier that, the theory is reparametrization invariant, so the total Hamiltonian is zero, the rest is just a sum of constraints, so the Hamiltonian is zero on shell. So if the Hamiltonian is zero on shell, for example, there is no energy. And that's not the case, because the Hamiltonian, in the sense generator of gauge transformations, this object is not zero on shell. On shell, it's equal to a surface term. This surface term gives you, for example, the ADM energy, which for Schwarzschild spacetime agrees with the Komar energy we computed before. Okay, now let's move to, now we leave the Hamiltonian picture and we go actually to the, now to the second theorem, because the whole point after all was to discuss the Noether second theorem. So we go back to the Lagrangian picture, discuss the second theorem. Okay. So I think 3.3. So the second theorem. Okay, for this we just have to realize that, let's think a bit about what is the form of a gauge transformation on a field. And the most general thing you could write, the form of a gauge transformation, is the following. So let me explain what I mean by this. So I take some field, not necessarily scalar field, but any field theory, the field content is phi. I have some gauge transformation acting on the field. And I'm just saying that the kind of general form of this is the following. I have some quantity, I call it R naught, that can depend on phi, derivatives of phi, and so on. And then something, there is just epsilon here. Now there is another term. I'm using kind of a shorthand notation. I don't want to write too many derivatives. But the point is that the form of the gauge transformation is, you see, the general form is that there will be derivatives acting on the fields and derivatives acting on the gauge parameters. It's exactly what we saw already in the mechanical examples from before. Or think about the Lie derivative along a vector field acting on the metric. This involves derivatives of the metric, partial derivatives of the metric, and partial derivatives of the vector field. So there are terms like this, arbitrary high derivatives of the field, maybe something linear in the gauge parameter, and then one that I call R1. It has an index here. Again, it depends on the field, derivatives of the field, and so on. And now maybe a first derivative of the gauge parameter. Now maybe you have, you know, R2. I could write R mu nu here and d mu epsilon, d mu d nu epsilon. So schematically, let me just write this d mu phi. See, so you have like no derivatives of epsilon, first order derivatives, second derivatives of epsilon. This contains derivatives of the fields. So it can have this very general structure and so on. Okay. Yeah, in fact, that's why I wanted to. Yeah, I could write like this, yeah, mu nu. It's less confusing here. Thanks. Okay, so that's just the general form of a gauge transformation. So now let's see why, just if we have this, it actually implies something. It immediately implies something a bit surprising, but that's why the theorem is really beautiful, because it implies something surprising but true. So what it implies is the following thing. Let's remember that for any Lagrangian, we have this. Using the same notations as before, we have the equations of motion, delta phi, plus, I keep this vector notation, sorry, theta. Okay, but now for a gauge transformation, you have this. I take the same formula, delta epsilon phi plus d mu theta mu on delta epsilon. If this is a symmetry, so now if the gauge transformation is a symmetry of the theory, and we know examples of this. We know this happens for diffeomorphisms in GR, U1 gauge transformations in Maxwell, gauge transformations in Yang-Mills. You have gauge symmetry, so you also have cases where this is a boundary term. But in fact, just with this, if you think about this and the fact that the general form of this gauge transformation of the field has these derivatives hanging around like this, You can convince yourself that the only possibility for this to work, for this to reduce to that, is that in here, if I do integration by parts to isolate epsilon, there is a bulk term which has to vanish. There is a bulk piece which, because epsilon is an independent spacetime function, it's an arbitrary spacetime function, the only way this can be true is if there is some bulk term which identically vanishes. And this condition, this is what we call the Noether identities coming from this gauge transformation. So integrating the bulk term by parts, we get what? So the statement is that I take this bulk term, E delta epsilon phi. This one I don't have to integrate by parts because epsilon is already here. And now, see, this one I have E R1 partial epsilon. I can integrate this by parts to isolate epsilon. And I will get, so this is E R0 minus d mu E R mu 1 plus, and so on, bunch of terms, epsilon, which I have isolated by doing this integration by parts. And now plus a total derivative, a boundary term, which is the one produced by these successive integrations by parts. I don't know what this boundary term is, but it will be here. So let's give it a name with a proper sign, put a minus sign, minus mu. Minus mu, I call it C epsilon. C epsilon, okay. In fact, we already know, so we know that structurally it has this, the term necessarily has this structure. The other thing we know that, see, this has the equations of motion, this has the equations of motion everywhere. So this boundary term C has to vanish on shell just because of how it is defined. So it's the minus sign is just a convention here with C mu epsilon, which is vanishing on shell. And so now we can conclude. The conclusion is that if these transformations are gauge transformations, to go from here, this is just any transformation. But if it happens that the transformation is a gauge transformation, then it's a symmetry. We have this. For this to be possible, to go from here to here, it means that this bulk term here has to identically vanish by construction. Otherwise, this cannot be true. And so if this term vanishes, this means that, well, you see what this tells us. It tells us that there are some kind of relationships between the equations of motion. And these relationships can even be differential relationships between the equations of motion. This is what we saw in the mechanical example earlier. We saw that the equations of motion were related. There were two equations of motion. One was the time derivative of the other one. It's because of this structure. So what we saw earlier in the mechanical example was an example of a neuter identity between the equations of motion following from gauge invariance of the theory. Here we're saying that if the theory has a gauge invariance, if it satisfies this, then it satisfies these differential relations between the equations of motion. So if delta epsilon is a gauge symmetry, then we have the so-called neuter identities. That's the important term here. And the neuter identities is just this term here. Again, as I said, this was just completely schematic to just think about this structure. It's not at all important to, the way to actually compute this is not by applying this formula. This is not a proper formula, right? You don't have to remember the placement of the indices or anything. You will see on the examples that when you compute this, you cannot make a mistake about the form of this. You really read this when you compute this transformation. You take the equations of motion times the gauge transformation of the field. You just compute that. You integrate by parts to isolate the gauge parameter, and you will read what the neuter identity is. We will do this for general relativity, and we will see that the neuter identity is the Bianchi identity. Hence the statement that the Bianchi identity is implied by diffeomorphism invariance. It's in fact the neuter identity implied by diffeomorphism invariance. So we have the neuter identities given by this. R0 minus d mu r mu 1 plus blah, blah, blah. This is identically equal to 0. It's not on shell. Huh? It's not an on shell statement. It's identically equal to 0. Because again, for this to be a symmetry, this is an off-shell statement. So this is off-shell identically equal to 0. OK. And because this is identically equal to 0, now we can state the second theorem. And so the statement of the second theorem, well, I don't know if that's the proper statement. I mean, this kind of includes the second. Everything here is the second theorem. But one small way to remember it is that is this. The second theorem. Second theorem is that so the equations of motion, gauge transformation of the field, this off shell is with our conventional minus sign C mu epsilon. Yes, there was a question.
Yeah. So what was the argument you gave for saying that the C mu term has to be zero on shell?
Because the way that C mu was defined by collecting the boundary term coming from this integration by parts.
Yeah.
But in the first place, this formula was built from the equations of motion. So see, on the left-hand side, they have the equations of motion. Then here, everywhere, there's the equations of motion, right? So if I go on shell, I get zero everywhere.
I see.
Okay. Yes, this with this. In fact, we will actually check why this works on examples. We will see. But now from this, now we haven't talked about the neuter current for the moment, right? We can still think about whether there is a first theorem, whether we can talk, and we have a symmetry, so we can talk about the neuter current. But now this tells us something about the form of the neuter current, in fact. It tells us about and by the way, the reason why I also here call this C is because this is actually related to the constraints of the theory. So we will see this on explicit examples later. So now we have, the conclusion is that we have this. So we have two things. We have d mu of theta mu on delta epsilon minus b mu. If we compute this now, so now this is what we called the neuter current earlier, j. Right? So this is the neuter current inside, so d mu of. This is the neuter current. But now this is also equal to C because of this equality here. Now using that, this is equal to d mu C mu epsilon. So in fact, the point is that J has the following form. The neuter current has the following form, epsilon. Now if I want to connect J and C, well, now there is, see, the problem is that there is this divergence here. So if I want to isolate the relationship between J and C, this is up to the divergence of some antisymmetric quantity. But now the important thing is that we'll have to keep track of this antisymmetric rank 2 quantity, and you will see that this antisymmetric rank 2 quantity is precisely related to the surface terms which we have discussed earlier. So we'll compute this in the example of Maxwell theory and GR. In GR, you will see that this rank 2 quantity is the Komar quantity that we introduced earlier. And so the point is this, is that J mu has this form. It has the form C mu epsilon plus d nu q mu nu. And this, I don't know if it's so conventional, I think this is called the Noether-Wald surface charge. It's not really a charge, it's not integrated yet. So let me just put quotation marks. So now we will check on examples that the neuter, if you go ahead and you blindly compute the neuter current, it always has this form. It has the form with the C that you get from these neuter identities, and you automatically identify a quantity Q here. So again, this C, now this is an off-shell statement. C is vanishing on shell, so C is the off-shell piece of the neuter current. C is vanishing on shell. And you see that on shell, what you have in the neuter current is a quantity of one dimension lower, in fact. This is why the interesting conservation laws that we have for gauge theories coming from the second theorem have to actually do with surface terms. So in terms of dimensionality, you recall we started from the Lagrangian. The Lagrangian is a, if you had worked with forms, as we will do earlier, the Lagrangian is a top form, so a four form in four dimensions. Then this is a codimension one piece on the boundary. It's one dimension lower. And now, so is J, right? J is kind of on the same level as theta. And Q is now a codimension two object. So this is why Q will naturally live and be integrated on two-dimensional surfaces. And so we will see that in Maxwell theory, this leads to the electric charge. And in general relativity, we compute this. This is the Komar charge that we introduced earlier. So it connects with what we had before. Okay, so I think we do that tomorrow. Yeah.
What did you give as an independent definition of J? So here you have the equality that between divergences. You need to define J and C independently. So C, you define it before as the what
yeah,
comes
and,
out.
Yeah, and J I define from like this.
So that's the definition of J, that combination.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so tomorrow, yeah, I thought we would have time to compute it now, but tomorrow, you will see on the, it looks maybe a bit puzzling why we have this, but you will see on examples that this, it always comes out, it always works like this. You can check for any gauge theory you like that you always get on the nose exactly this structure. Yes? Ah, yes.
So also here the gauge symmetries are related to an ambiguity in a way that we formulate our degrees of freedom rather than a symmetry. And if we go to quantum mechanics, for example, and went to solve that by constraint or Hilbert space, and that is not really a symmetry. So I don't know. Is this perspective also applied here? It seems like a gauge symmetry is really a case of a symmetry in what you said.
At the end, you said what? It seems that a gauge symmetry is really a...
Just like a redundancy in our degrees of freedom, our description of the system.
I would say that this point of view would be true if you didn't have a boundary, in fact. But when you have a boundary, you see that the notion of gauge becomes kind of ambiguous because you would want to call a true gauge symmetry something which has a vanishing conserved, just a vanishing Noether charge. So these are the true constraints. But as soon as you have a boundary, you see that they change status a bit. They get promoted to true Noether symmetries. So in this sense, they actually, when you act with these objects on the system, they actually do something. So this distinction can only happen if you have a boundary. It's really the boundary that does this, that allows for this mechanism to happen. Because you will see that the interesting information is really in this term here, which here seems a bit ambiguous because you see this term is just because when you remove this, it's defined up to some quantity Q. Now the point is that if you take this as a definition of J, you will actually read a Q. And now Q is a candidate. What you're just looking for is a candidate for a conserved quantity. And if you can exhibit a candidate conserved quantity, which is related, as we argued, to a gauge symmetry, then you can go ahead and ask if this conserved quantity is meaningful. If it's we will argue that in Maxwell, this is related to the electric charge. In general relativity, this is related to the Komar charge. As we argued, this is related to the energy. So this is, it suggests that it's a meaningful way to identify a conserved quantity. By just going ahead, even though we are in a gauge theory, you compute this and you identify this piece which is here.
Maybe you'll go into this tomorrow, but I'm curious why we know that we can always write C as a derivative. Going from the line above to the line below, like we're writing theta del mu q. Reading this equation wrong.
Well, so this was our definition of the Noether current, the first.
And then to define the Noether Wald charge.
Well, here I'm integrating this.
Maybe so. I just have to work out.
But this, you agreed, comes from this, right? In fact, in this definition of the gauge transform, in this definition, which is the fact that there are two things. There's the fact that this is a gauge transformation, so it's a symmetry, so it produces a boundary term. And the second thing is that this, by the Noether identity, is also a boundary term. So all you have left is a relationship between boundary terms.
Thank you. That explains.
Sense. Yeah. Yeah, maybe it will become more obvious on examples.
Any other question?
Okay.
Mark.
Thanks.